There's some voting districts. There's one district this year that has just one voter, who's a lady who lives on top of a mountain with her kids. And they're sending a whole, you know, team from the Election Commission to let this one lady push the button one time.
Hello and welcome to Insights from Abroad. This podcast is part of the Middle East and South Asia Initiative in the College of Sciences at the University of Central Florida. And my name is Brian Cruz. Our mission here is to educate, engage, and influence the international community. Today, I am joined by Max Rodenbeck to discuss some topics surrounding our South Asia series. Max, thank you for joining me today.
Thanks, Brian. It's great to be here.
Max Rodenbeck is a journalist and author working as a South Asia bureau chief for The Economist. Rodenbeck's most notable work is Cairo, the City Victorious, which provides a comprehensive and vivid overview of the city's history and future as it has been translated to 8 different languages. Rodenbeck has been a longtime contributor for The Economist, previously being their chief Middle East correspondent for 15 years. He's also been published in other publications such as The New York Times and Foreign Policy. As we know, India is a unique country in many ways. How can you best describe the country to a listener who is unfamiliar with the region?
Well, India is a huge country. It's so big and so populous that it's really more like a continent than a country. It's got 1.3 billion people. Although on the map it doesn't look like it's that large, it's actually about the size of the kind of eastern half of the United States, something like that, the U.S. Kind of east of the Mississippi. But into that space you put in 1.3 billion people. And then 1.3 billion people with at least 22 major languages, and these are really very different languages. It's not like, you know, just, you know, different variations of a similar thing. They're quite different with even different scripts, so they can't mutually read each other. And then about 800 other languages, smaller languages, and then on top of that, you've got many different religions, different ethnicities. There are Indians who look like they're Chinese, Indians who look like they're basically European, and Indians who look like they're African. So it's all combined in one space. That variety is one of the things that's kind of crucial to understand India.
And so, can you give us an overview of the Indian political climate and system? What are some of the key similarities and differences with those of other countries?
Well, it is a democracy. It's the world's biggest democracy by quite a long way. So it's easy to draw parallels between India and lots of other places, but none of them quite fit, So in terms of the political system, something that struck me, and I wasn't expecting that, I've been in India now for 3 years, when I first got there, is how much it's like the United States in some ways, although it's obviously a much poorer country. It's a lot more crowded. It's very different in many ways from the U.S., but in terms of a giant, really messy, loud, sometimes obnoxiously noisy kind of democracy, which is sometimes corrupt and sometimes dysfunctional. It reminds me kind of the United States. And right now, with Prime Minister Narendra Modi in power, who's a populist leader, who's a little bit divisive and can be very abrasive, there's a lot to remind you of America with Donald Trump as president. Of course, they're very different kinds of people, but the sort of populist wave that carried Modi to power in 2014, that was the last big election. Elections happen every 5 years, general elections in India. That was not dissimilar to the kind of wave that put Donald Trump in the presidency in the U.S. But of course, there are key differences in how India works as a democracy. It's modeled more on British kind of parliamentary democracy. So India does have a president, but the president is functions like just a figurehead, and the real power rests with the prime minister. And the prime minister stays in power as long as the prime minister holds a majority in parliament. And then assuming that the prime minister has kept his majority. His or her majority, elections happen every 5 years. And so we're coming up now to a big election. It will be the world's biggest democratic event ever, with 900 million voters, so many voters that it has to be spread over 7 phases to get everyone packed in to vote. And that's going to be very interesting.
With a democracy of that scale, what is their system of counting votes? Do they have a similar system to the U.S.? How do they manage to keep such a large election under control?
Well, this is one of the things that I find really impressive about India, is actually they've got a much better system than the U.S. system. and it's a poorer country, but they've got their election, like the logistics of election, they've really got it together. You know, you'll never have a problem like the hanging chads problem that, that happened in Florida, you know, 12 years ago. Because in India, it's all done by electric voting machines, actual machines. And there are, you know, tens of thousands, actually probably more like more than a million of these machines that are one in every voting booth. And they're not centrally linked, so you can't like hack into them. They're just, you know, standalone machines that are then physically brought to one location. And then the results are tallied all at one time. It's actually a really good system. And so they actually managed to get 900 million people to vote. They actually even send out teams if there's some voting districts. There's one district this year in this vote that has just one voter who's a lady who lives on top of a mountain with her kids. And they're sending a whole, you know, team from the Election Commission with the machines and a policeman and a monitor and someone to operate the machine and someone to oversee the whole thing. There's a whole team that's going to hike for a whole day carrying this stuff up the mountain on mules, I think, to let this one lady push the button one time. But it's taken that seriously in India to really give everyone the chance to vote. And it's one of the things that India's kind of got right and is pretty impressive. So it's done in seven phases because there's some parts of India, some states which are a little bit where the politics are kind of rough. And so to make sure that there are enough police to keep the polling stations safe, they actually put it into phases so that they can redeploy police to wherever is needed. So what happens is all the voting takes place and all the voting machines are then collected in various centers, but they don't count the votes until May 23rd is going to be the big count. So Indians will not know what the results of these seven phases are until it's all counted at once on the 23rd of May.
That's very interesting, especially considering that in the United States we have a one-day voting phase, and voting over time is definitely a way to account for the vast population and everyone's different time scheduling. So that's very interesting that you mentioned that. So, as you mentioned, elections are coming up in India. Can you give us a general overview of the political parties and sides to this election?
Sure, yeah. In such a huge country, it's a very complicated scene. I mean, there are, you know, not just two political parties, but there are actually hundreds of political parties in India. A lot of them are just regional and very local parties. Because India is so divided up by language, it's really difficult to have a kind of national party. But within that picture of hundreds of parties, there are two main parties that each of which try to put together national scale alliances. And the two parties are that the currently ruling party is known as the BJP, the Bharatiya Janata Party. That's Prime Minister Modi's party, which is basically a conservative party. And there's and its main challenger is the Indian National Congress Party, whose leader is Rahul Gandhi, who's actually the fifth generation in his family to actually lead the party, which goes back to like his family's been involved in Congress Party since the 1920s. Congress Party is relatively a more liberal party. And the Congress Party was the party that led India, led the independence movement in India, and has led India for decades after independence in 1947. So that was Congress. But they have, over time, lost a lot of their power just by, you know, as naturally happens over time, and gotten sort of flabby and a little bit corrupt. And in the last 20, 30 years, the rival, the BJP, has kind of gained a lot of power. And so, I mean, in some ways, it's not dissimilar to Republicans and Democrats, you know, in a certain way, although the parties are very different and Indian issues are really different from American issues. So that's one way to think about it. And so winning votes is important for both parties, but almost as important as actually winning votes is managing your alliances with all the smaller parties. And that's really the trickiest part of Indian politics. Because like the Congress Party just doesn't have enough muscle to like run in every seat. There are 543 seats right now that are up for grabs in the parliamentary election. And Congress can't run in every seat. It just doesn't have the power or scope or money to actually put up candidates in every single seat. So it's got to seek allies all over the country. And that is a really contentious process because you have to give in, concede to local parties. Sometimes money helps. And in this competition between Congress and the BJP, the ruling party, the BJP, has a lot more money. Big businesses have poured money into the BJP. And so it's a big imbalance in terms of money. So Narendra Modi has more money. And then, so that's the kind of the way the game is working. But in terms of like ideology, they're also very polar opposites, the two parties. So this election is particularly kind of emotive, potent, and the outcome is going to be really important for the future of India. The Prime Minister's party, the BJP, is not just that it's conservative, as you know, like an American conservative party is. It's also got a kind of an agenda that's a Hindu nationalist agenda. Hindus are about 80% of the population in India. And among Hindus, there's immense diversity of like different kinds of Hinduism, different castes, so there's class differences. But this Hindu nationalist kind of ideological strain, their idea is to kind of unite all Hindus and turn India into a sort of essentially Hindu nation, in the same way that like Israel calls itself a Jewish state, or like you've got, you know, Iran is an Islamic republic. They kind of see India as being a Hindu nation, you know. The opposing view, which is the Congress party, and actually most of the opposition, and most of the smaller parties, view India, according to the Indian constitution and the whole independence movement and India's previous history, which is to see India as a secular state in which, you know, everybody is an equal citizen, everyone is equal. And the identifying thing about India for them is the diversity of India. And of course, you know, they're not against Hinduism. It's just, you know, Hinduism is one of many things. You know, that's the way they see it. So there is a kind of deep underlying polarization and struggle between these two visions of India. And that's kind of what people are voting on right now. And that's what makes it an interesting and really kind of historic election, because these two ideological strains have been there for a long time in India. But this particular election, they're kind of more dramatically opposed, because Modi, the Prime Minister, who's a very strong figure, really represents most ideologically committed kind of Hindu nationalism that's ever been in power in India. And he's already had 5 years in power, and a lot of people feel that if he has another 5 years in power, then he might actually, you know, complete this mission of really transforming India into a different kind of place.
So you say Hindu nationalism is the deciding factor of this election. What is the importance of other issues, such as like economics or local issues? How do they play into a role of this giant ideological divide?
That's a really good question. And I mean, in some ways, economic issues for a lot of voters are going to be more important than these ideological things. I mean, clearly, that's, you know, it's just that the outcome, when I talk about the importance of ideology, it has to do with like what the future of India looks like. But for most voters, of course, it's like bread and butter issues are more important. So one issue that's very important is unemployment, actually. On paper, it doesn't look like India has high unemployment rates. But the reality for a lot of, especially young people, is that there just aren't jobs out there. And a lot of people go through college, expensive education, and then find there's nothing that they can do that their qualifications match. So you have these something that happened earlier this year. There was a job opening for something like 20 people to work in a government like cafeteria, you know, and they had something like 60,000 people apply, including 2,000 people with PhDs, you know. So there's just tremendous pressure on the job market, and that is a big cause for upset. Also, it plays out in funny ways. I mean, so India has a really elaborate system, what they call reservations, which is, what they mean by reservations is like affirmative action, you know, like there are reserved places in state colleges, there are reserved places in state employment for people in certain categories. The idea is to kind of pull up the most unfortunate parts of a society. And this is something that's actually in the Indian constitution. So there are certain categories like, what, you know, the Dalits, who are so used to be called untouchables in India, are guaranteed a certain number of proportion of places in state institutions. And what's happened more recently is that other categories have been pressuring to be included in these reservation system. And it's gotten kind of ridiculous now that they're virtually, you know, almost anybody now can be part of the reservation system by claiming to be, you know, part of some category. to the point where in some states, almost 60% of all government places are like for reserved categories of people. But that's one way that this plays out politically, is you get, you know, like caste groups who are pressuring for more government goodies. And that happens a lot. And this government, in lead up to the election, the Modi government has been doing a lot of handouts, you know, like waiving loans made to farmers, suddenly the farmers don't have to pay them back anymore. Big cash bonuses for all kinds of stuff. So there've been a lot of giveaways that the government has done. And then the opposition, for its part, the Congress Party, has been promising, you know, when we get into power, we'll have a minimum guaranteed income for people. We'll have, more benefits for farmers, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot of promising handouts. So economics is a key issue for a lot of people. And then because India is so diverse, each state also has many other different issues. I mean, some states have a real issue with a nationality situation, where they've enacted legislation to give only the natives of that state the right to like own property and work in the government, and are very jealous about that and don't like a big influx of immigrants from other parts of India, you know. So that's an issue in some places. Other places have issues that are just like, you know, infrastructure. You know, they want more, better water distribution, electricity, you know, that kind of thing. So there's a huge range of different issues. Then people want a better education system, for example. India has a really very bad public education system. So a wide range of issues. Yeah.
So there has been issues surrounding India-China relations, from border tensions to China to vetoes in the UN Security Council. Can you fill us in a bit of that? Does that play a role in international or domestic politics for India?
Yeah. Well, India's has a slightly tense relationship with China for a long time. And, you know, these are the two big giants of Asia. In terms of population, they're almost even now. And actually, India's going to overtake China in just a few years. So India will actually be more populous than China within the next 10 years or so. And they are, you know, ancient neighbors also. And luckily, they're separated by the Himalayas, which is in the world's highest mountains. So, you know, they don't actually rub up against each other too much. But even so, there are some little border parts that have never been really very well defined between them. And so there's a constant little itchiness, you know, along the borders between India and China, with each side claiming parts of the other country. Not big parts, but small little bits here and there. And so there's always room for trouble, you know, between India and China. And the other thing is that India's longest standing, you know, foreign policy problem, you know, is its relations with Pakistan. And of course, you know, Pakistan was split off from India at independence when there was partition between India and Pakistan. Pakistan turned into a Muslim country, and India remained a sort of secular, mixed-up country with a big Hindu majority. And the border between Pakistan and India has always been tense ever since then, and there have been several wars fought. Pakistan and China are close allies now, and there's actually been a war, serious war fought between India and China way back in the 1960s. So the combination of China and Pakistan is India's kind of nightmare. You know, that's their strategic problem that they kind of have to deal with all the time. But China and Pakistan, although they're close allies, there's completely different levels of kind of animosity between India and each one. India and Pakistan have been locked into, you know, sort of a virtual Cold War for decades. And there are a lot of issues where they don't get along, and Pakistan has funded terrorist groups that have attacked India, but at the same, Pakistan accuses India of dominating a Muslim majority region of Kashmir. So there's constant animosity. With China, it's not as tense, but there's a kind of more of a competition. You know, India's a rising country. China's grown a lot faster. I mean, if you look back 30, 40 years ago, the two countries were basically at the same level of development. And China has just raced ahead so fast that it's left India, you know, kind of stunned and far behind. In recent years, India's economy has actually growing faster than China's. So India is catching up, but pretty slowly, actually. I mean, China now has an economy that's five times India's size, even though they have almost the same population. So China's just raced ahead, and China's way ahead in things like infrastructure. And so in terms of whose military is stronger, the Chinese don't need to spend very much as a proportion of their GDP to have a much more powerful military than India does. India kind of struggles to keep up. And last year there was one of these little border things that kind of erupted briefly, and there was a kind of tense moment between the two countries. But I think neither of them really want to escalate problems. In fact, they have a big trading. Trade between the two countries amounts to like $70-80 billion a year, and with a big surplus in favor of China. So the Chinese don't want to mess with India particularly, but India is feeling increasingly kind of encroached on by China. Not only does China have an alliance with Pakistan, but the Chinese Navy is starting to be more active in the Indian Ocean. Chinese like money and aid is now going to a lot of countries that used to be very much inside India's sphere of influence. I mean, smaller countries like Nepal, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, the Maldives, all these countries surrounding India that traditionally India is kind of dominated, has been the big brother in the neighborhood. So much massively bigger than all these smaller countries. And China has kind of made inroads diplomatically and economically in a lot of these places, which gets India kind of worried. So far, there's no reason for serious tension, but it does worry India.
Yeah. And you brought up Pakistan in that answer. That also brings up the Pakistan militant attack in Indian Kashmir. How has that impacted domestic politics for India?
Well, happened on Valentine's Day, February 14th. There was a bomb explosion that hit a convoy of Indian police, killed about 40 policemen, and it was the biggest single loss of life for Indian security forces in Kashmir ever, I think. And so that was quite a shock to the system. Kashmir has been in a state of unrest for a very long time, for 30 years or so. And it's a particular part of Kashmir. Kashmir is actually a large state, but there's one part of the state which is the kind of the focus of all this unrest. It's the Kashmir Valley, which is kind of a very beautiful region, a highland region of lakes and mountains. And that is very heavily Muslim dominated. I mean, it's 95% Muslim population who also speak their own language. They're quite a different kind of people. I mean, you feel in Kashmir that you're in a foreign country, but they are part of India, have been part of India since partition. They ended up on the Indian side of the border. So there's been this tension, and Pakistan has constantly stirred up Kashmiri separatism. And Pakistan has for decades kind of infiltrated various guerrilla groups and jihadist groups, Islamist groups, into Indian administered Kashmir to stir up separatist feeling. And India has responded by pretty heavy-handed police control and crackdown, so that sometimes Kashmir can feel like an occupied country. And in this cycle of like violence, the local Kashmiris, there are only about 7 million people, which for India is a small number, in the Kashmir Valley, have become more and more alienated from India. And something that's happened in recent years is that the very small number of guerrillas and insurgents who are actually operating on the ground in Kashmir, more and more of them are actually local Kashmiris and not people who've come snuck in across the border from Pakistan. So that's a frightening thing for the Indian government. This government under Modi has adopted a policy of pretty hard, sort of iron-fisted security crackdown in Kashmir, which has further exacerbated and alienated the local people. So there's been an unhappy cycle going on there. And when this bomb went off, it was kind of a shock to all of India. And because Prime Minister Modi has kind of made his name as a tough guy, he's acted like, I'm going to be tougher on foreign policy than anyone else, he was kind of bound to respond pretty hard. And so everyone expected that India would retaliate against Pakistan, because the group that carried out this particular bombing is based in Pakistan, although the actual suicide bomber was a local Kashmiri guy, an Indian. But the group that sponsored it, presumably trained him, supplied the explosives, all that stuff was based in Pakistan. So India responded by sending the Indian Air Force to bomb a training camp for the same terrorist group in Pakistan. And in doing so, they violated Pakistani territory. And so then Pakistan responded by striking some empty ground in India just to show, we won't let you do this. And there was a little aerial battle. And in that aerial battle, one Indian fighter plane got shot down and the pilot landed in Pakistan. And then the Pakistanis, to kind of cool down this sudden escalation of tensions, which, you know, escalations of tensions between India and Pakistan, you're talking about two nuclear-armed countries. I mean, there's a real danger there, who really don't like each other. So Pakistan wisely decided to, you know, release this captured pilot almost immediately, like the next day. So how this all played out politically in India was that it came as a great gift, in fact, politically speaking, to the ruling party and to the prime minister, to Mr. Modi, because it allowed him to sort of act like a tough guy. You know, we struck back. You know, they carried out a bomb. It's a great national tragedy, but I am defending the borders and I've sent our air force to bomb these people, etc. In retaliation. The BJP has contrasted that with previous governments, which were more careful about how they responded to similar kinds of provocations. Among a lot of common people, this kind of muscular look for India, you know, like we will strike back and we're going to act tough, that plays very well to the public. So there's no question that was useful politically to Modi. But in Indian politics, there's so many local issues. It's difficult to say how important that one factor of looking tough internationally is. For a lot of Indians, you know, it's other issues that are going to be more important. It also depends which part of India you're in. Like the regions that are closest to Pakistan are the ones that care most about, you know, Indian relations with Pakistan. But if you go to the opposite end of India, people don't really think about it. I mean, it's something happening virtually in another country, you know. So it's definitely a plus score for Modi. Gives him a little more electoral kind of boost. But how much of a boost, we won't really know until the election.
Right. And it's important to note that because being such a big country as India, you really can't factor in conflicts on certain borders to interest everyone, especially when the differences in the country are as they are.
Yeah.
So Modi has seemingly been focusing on an economic platform. And to go back to economics here a little bit, how much economic change has come out of it? Does it seem like a success story that he can pull for the Indian election?
It's on the economic side, it's a kind of mixed picture what Modi has achieved in his 5 years in power. The thing is that when Modi won the election in 2014, he got a tremendous mandate. I mean, it's rare in Indian politics that one single party gets the majority at the center of the government, and, you know, in Delhi, you know, gets the majority of parliamentary seats. Usually they do it with allies. And in 2014, Modi actually won a full-fledged majority for himself. With a big mandate for change. I mean, he campaigned for economic reform on a platform of economic reform, and by accusing his opponents of corruption and screwing up the economy. And so when he came in 2014, there was an immense mandate for reform and change. And his government has done quite a few things, but, you know, they've done some reforms, they've done some changes, they've done some useful economic legislation. The economy has done okay under Modi. And all this is fine, and, you know, they've kept the budget fairly balanced, and, you know, all these kind of macroeconomic things look okay, you know, decent growth rates and so on. The problem is that they haven't performed to what the expectation was, so they've kind of disappointed in many ways, and a lot of the economic reforms have been like two steps forward, one step back, you know. There's a little bit less corruption in government, possibly, and they've streamlined some bureaucratic procedures, but they've made other things more tricky. You know, taxation is heavier and it's more tricky than it used to be, so that annoys a lot of business people. You know, and then they've also made some useful new rules to, you know, make business easier, like bankruptcy rules and so on, that allow you to exit a business, you know, enter a business or exit a business without, you know, that used to be a big, very cumbersome thing in India that really held back businessmen. And so they've made that easier, but at the same time did some really stupid policies that, you know, there was this strange incident where Modi imposed what they called demonetization, where they suddenly, like overnight, withdrew all the like paper money from, you know, it became illegal. You know, suddenly, like, you know, imagine $20, $50, $100 bills are suddenly illegal everywhere. In an economy that works largely on cash, you know, I mean, half the Indian economy works just purely by cash. And you suddenly make this money illegal. The idea was somehow that, you know, the black money hidden under mattresses would, you know, it would all come out. And there was a kind of slightly wacky idea. But what this did was, like, really freeze the economy, you know, the kind of especially at the lower level, like for the real poor, like people who work as day laborers, construction workers. Suddenly, there's like no cash to pay them. That was a real problem, and that was kind of a failure of a policy. So it's a really mixed picture in terms of economy. But basically, no terrible failures. But it's hard to point to like a great success, and they have not lived up to what they wanted to. So when you come to the election now, Modi can't really campaign on a platform of "I've done economic great stuff." It's not great. You know, the economic growth rates were actually better 10 years ago than they are now.
Right. And with the international achievements that Modi has not being very important, and with economic change not being very prevalent under him, it seems that Hindu nationalism, as you mentioned, is kind of what will be a lot of defining characteristics for his campaign.
Yeah, I think that's right. But and another thing that will be that's going to be important for the campaign for the ruling party, BJP, is just this projection of strength. I mean, so, you know, internationally speaking, you can't actually point to some great, you know, successes, but there's the image. On the image side, Modi has projected strength, and to his own people, he projects an image of strength. And I think what a lot of Indians will do is to compare Modi to the alternative. And it's there that's the real advantage that the BJP has. It's because the Congress Party looks weak by comparison. Everyone knows that Congress is going to have to rely on a very wobbly coalition with a lot of allies. And the Congress leader, Rahul Gandhi, who's becoming a better politician now, but he does carry this burden of being somebody who like inherited his job. You know, he didn't have to work for it. And he is not as skilled a, you know, orator as Modi. Modi's a very skilled politician, you know, a real professional. And Rahul Gandhi is younger, in some ways more dynamic, in some ways more thoughtful, and more of a real person in some ways, but is not as good at projecting an image of like strength and unity. And so I think a lot of Indians may end up choosing between what they think is a stronger party or a weaker party. And on that basis, I think the BJP has a lot of advantage. It also, I should mention, that it has a lot more money, you know, and that is really important in Indian elections, you know.
Right, and so this brings me to my opposition question. So Rahul Gandhi, as you mentioned, it's kind of a give and take where, despite not being as powerful, at least he has a more compassionate edge that may appeal to some voters. And so what chances do Rahul Gandhi and overall political opposition have in the upcoming election? What are the distinct advantages and disadvantages that they want to push and minimize, respectively?
Well, I think Congress I mean, one advantage that the Congress has is this long in Indian tradition of what they call anti-incumbency. I mean, people have often said that the most powerful force in Indian politics is anti-incumbency. I mean, is being against whoever's in office, you know, being the power to vote people out of office. And Indians have historically exercised this with great relish, you know, get the jerks out of power. And that's often happened in Indian elections, that you know, just parties alternate because people are always voting somebody out of power. So that's a strong card in the hand of Congress. A lot of people are very tired of Modi. And there's a feeling among a lot of middle-class Indians, especially, that the BJP and Modi have overplayed their hand in terms of like trying to actually take over state institutions and make them work for the government. So there have been a lot of incidents of, you know, like the, for example, the Indian equivalent of like the FBI has been hounding opposition people, but leaving alone any people who are favored by the government. You know, like all the investigations happen to be, surprise, surprise, against the political enemies of Modi. You know, so there's a lot of that. The kind of instrumentalizing of the government by the ruling party has angered a lot of, especially educated Indians. And so the Congress Party has that on its side. So there's been a kind of blowback against Modi being too strong and too dominant and too aggressively pushing his kind of Hindu nationalist agenda. And it should also be mentioned that, you know, Modi himself, not so much his party, but Modi and the small group around him are very heavily influenced by and often are members of a group called the RSS, which is a Hindu nationalist social group with millions of members, very powerful, and it's kind of infiltrated into all parts of the Indian state and establishment. And Modi and his closest associates are actually members of the RSS. So there's a from the opposition side, people point to this as a kind of takeover of the Indian government by this kind of slightly shadowy group. So that's a card in favor of Congress to be able to point this out. And another thing is that the BJP, the kind of conservative party, has been more favored by upper class Hindus and less by lower class Hindus. They've tried to change this over time and tried to reach out more to lower castes. But traditionally, the Congress party has been more favored by the kind of lower classes in India, because historically it's actually given people a lot of things. I mean, a lot of the policies that Congress has pushed for over many, many years, over decades, actually did try to uplift the poor. And minority groups also. I mean, the Congress has reached out to Muslims, to Sikhs, to Christians, all these smaller minority groups that together make up about 20% of the Indian electorate. And the BJP is seen by a lot of these minority groups as pretty hostile, actually. So they're like, you know, there's some considerably large chunks of the electorate that would be favorable to Congress.
Thank you for that response. So to wrap up, if there's one thing you want listeners to take away from our talk today, what would it be?
That's a really difficult question. One thing, wow. When you talk about India, it's hard to talk about any one thing. I mean, you know, one of the things that's said about India is if you say anything that you say about India, the opposite is also true. So, I mean, that may be the one thing to take away, is that India is so diverse and so complex that you shouldn't come to any firm conclusions about anything, because the opposite is very likely to be true.
All right. Well, Max, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak with you today, and we thank you so much for being here and sharing your experience with us.
Thanks. Thanks, Brian.
If you want to learn more about today's guest, our mission, or our program, you can visit us at the PMBF website or go follow any of our social media pages. For the Middle East and South Asian Studies program here at UCF, this is Brian Cruz. Thank you for listening.